So you worked at Travis Matthew for 11 years so far, right?
Oh, I'm no, I've got a lot of gray hairs. No, I'm at 16 and a half, be 17 in July.
And you were their first employee.
Yeah, first employee. Myself and Joey Quirk, who's now our head of design, who's always kind of been our head of design. Yeah.
And those two guys ran it essentially for 16 years, you and Joey.
No, actually, we've had a bunch of, I've been promoted, I think, 11 times in 16 years, and I was basically the first salesperson hired, and then
wow,
started running sales and merchandising, and then eventually completely took over design. Oh, I was running ops, too, and then, you know, we started hiring and growing, and then I, you know, took over design and headed that up with Joey, and then became president in 2016, and then 2020 hit. Pandemic, and Travis said, here, you want this? Take it.
And then you said, during the craziest time for apparel businesses ever.
But it was really good because for me, like, I'm very adaptable. That's how I've moved throughout this company. And it was a time we needed adaptation, not just with COVID and things happening, but BLM moving and all these things that, like, our employees wanted us to talk about that we weren't talking about. And I kind of had went to Travis actually before COVID in November of 19 and said, hey, I think we need to move some things culturally. We've got a lot of people and we're treating the business like we have 30 people still and we don't. And the voice is not getting heard and we need to communicate more transparency. And we've got to talk about topics and issues. We're not going to be a political company, but people want to hear and they want to see empathy from us. And we weren't providing that. And so it was a perfect time. And Travis was great and very gracious, like handed that off and said, hey, that's your passion. Go run with it.
Going back to the early days to kind of start the timeline there, what was like the hardest years to start when you guys got going? Obviously from you guys were in the garage stage to, you know, seeing some significant scale. What was like the hardest?
Well, we were constructed very differently than I think most companies. So it was probably the first 2 years were the hardest because you had Travis Brasher. There's multiple Travises, which makes it hard just to begin. Yeah. Travis Brasher was the head pro at a country club and he had the investor and he was always going to be the CEO, whatever that position was running the company. And so, and then we had a Travis Johnson who sort of had the idea of the company. Mm-hmm. Neither of them were in-house full-time. In fact, Travis Brasher was still working full-time because we couldn't really afford him. And Travis Johnson was trying to go on tour and play golf.
Got it.
So you had Joey and I sitting in the office, but they had opinions on how we should do it, what should run, but they weren't in the office. And so I think the first year was really challenging just getting them to understand, like, when the numbers aren't, their expectations on numbers were so high. I mean, I think we did $350,000 the first year, maybe a million year two. We did a million year two, and there was, like, a big disappointment. And I'd been in the industry for 10 years or 8 years, and I'm like, guys, this is really good.
Yeah.
I understand we're not profitable, but it's a pretty known thing. You don't get profitable in apparel till at least $5 million.
Yeah.
And so convincing them this should keep going, and we got to a point probably 18 months in where I thought we were having a lot of success. I was grinding the pavement, but I was the only sales guy. Wow. And we were only selling to wholesale. And again, doing $500,000 at the time between, you know, over 100 accounts we opened. And I remember sitting down with the investor. We had an investor who was more of a silent investor. We sat down with him and said, hey, I don't know if we want this business to move forward. Like, we've got to show more growth quicker. And so we built a plan out, and then a pivotal point, which is all these things are so weird how they come together, is his neighbor comes to his house. This is about 18 months into the business and says, hey, has no idea he owns Travis Matthew because he's not vocal about it. And he's head to toe in Travis Matthew and says, have you seen this product? Wow. This is the best product I've ever seen. Like, whoever makes this, and he goes off and finally tells him, yeah, I'm the owner. He goes, no, I can't believe it. This is unbelievable. So he came in the next day and said,
that's cool.
Literally sat down and said, okay, I'm ready to invest more. Because that's what it was going to take, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we're at that stage where I don't know what he had put in, $500,000, mm-hmm. $750,000. It was going to take another million to, like, take that next step. Mm-hmm. And I think he was seriously contemplating, like, all right, I've sunk enough into this. It was a fun little project. Should we do this? And it's funny how dumb that little thing is and how much luck it took. I always say, like, we've had the golden horseshoe of that timing to say, okay, now I'm ready to invest because somebody sees a vision. It happens to be my neighbor.
And not having to go out and raise and waste time, you could just go back to that guy. I mean, that must have been huge.
Yeah, I mean, you know, money is a big thing when you're starting a company. Yeah. And you know, you have to invest. You have to spend money to make money. And, mm-hmm. To go continue to get new ownership and all that. We were very fortunate to have the same owner for the 12 years before we sold, or 11 years. And always, we built everything on ROI. So if we could build him a plan, say, we want to go spend this money and this is what it's going to make. There was never, we're going to spend money. It's just going to build brand awareness. It was always like, build me a plan to spend it and show me what it's going to make. track it, follow up. If it doesn't work, you know, evaluate it and change and adjust, right? And we always built a culture off of that. So like anytime a salesperson or even anyone came to us to go invest, it's like, okay, what's it going to make for us?
Mm-hmm. And going from the first sales rep where you're just, you know, going door to door to the president of a company that is owned by a public companies, which obviously is a lot different than 30 people. Like, how is that transition going from role to role? So you've probably now what sat in 10, 15 different roles since you've started.
Yeah. It's a learning curve to kind of figure out like what you like and what you're good at and trying to marry those things. So like I was running sales and operations. In operations, it wasn't really operations like you think of it today. It was like, I would go pack a box. I'd put the order in the system, pack a box, and I'd ship it. But, you know, it's a little more complicated than that. But that thing every day, you would get the satisfaction of, we invoiced 40,000 orders a day versus on the sales side, you would go out there and you just get beat down every day and you'd make one sale of every 20 people you tried to sell. And so, you know, there's a pivotal point for me where I got with Travis and said, hey, he said, we need to move you into that next role, and you can't do sales and ops. Like, those kind of contradict each other. Yeah. We need to go, and you're a sales guy. And I really didn't know that at the time, and so it really helped me be introspective of, like, wow, I don't even know what I'm good at. I'm, like, 10 years into the business, and I don't think I'm a sales guy, and I'm, like, a true sales guy. And so that taught me a lot of, like, always every year kind of reflecting and going, okay, let's list out what I'm doing, where I'm putting my energy and effort, where I'm good. Let me meet with my boss and go, where do you think I'm good? Where do you think I should put my energy and effort? And let's merge the two of those together to kind of navigate through what I should do best. And I realized to be president or even CEO of the company, I don't have to be A+ in every facet of the business.
Yeah.
It's okay that I'm exceptional at product. I'm great at retail. I'm great at sales. I'm good at marketing. Like, I have those brand pieces. I just need to go hire people for the other positions. Mm-hmm. So it really enabled me to say, I think a lot of people at Travis Matthew were like playing hero ball, and I'm one of them. That, like, I love owning it. I do everything. Everyone tells me I'm great. Isn't that awesome? And then realizing, no, I need to empower people. I need to put the right people in the right positions to win. When I really started getting promoted is when I put people under me that were better than me. Mm-hmm. It enabled me to elevate, and then I could think more clearly and come up with more future ideas, be more strategic.
And what has been the biggest difference in, like, being a good manager for a 30-person team versus now a 350-person corporate team?
I mean, delegation obviously is the easy one. You know, I think positive communication, you know, Gary Vee says positivity with practicality, which I absolutely love, because I think if we can come at things from a can-do, it's really fun. If we come out and immediately start poking holes, it's not as much fun. But also on the other side, if you're not practical, the sky's falling and the building's burning and we're like, hey, buddy, it's fine. Just like, look at these great shirts. Like, you know what I mean? It's like, no, okay, it's all right. We're going to make it. Let me show you how we're going to get the heck out of here. And so I think that, you know, the difference at 30 is we used to have like really harsh, like direct conversations with people all the time and kind of go.
That's the culture. That's how
get
you
get on
it.
Our back.
Yeah.
We have the solution, have the answers. So just follow us. And at some point people were like, screw you. Like, you're the president of the company. You're the CEO. You're probably making X amount of money. Like, I'm doing all the work. Like, I don't, your blueprint, you don't even know how to do my job, right? And even someone like me who's done every job, it's still at some point I probably couldn't do that job, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm that elevated. And so, you know, learning how to communicate better in the organization, understanding that, like, the bigger communication has to always be positive. Mm-hmm. We do still need to have those individual conversations to let people know where they stand. But coming at it from empathy and understanding that everyone's in a different place. Yeah, I'm in my 40s now. I started in my early 20s. And now it's like, yeah, I've got 2-3 generational gaps.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't walk in the room thinking I know what to do. I should be more nimble. I should understand the employer.
Be curious.
Be curious and nimble and saying, hey, I need to understand. I need to change my approach to this person. They don't need to change theirs, right? I can't be the Kool-Aid man breaking down the wall and then just walking out and the place is a mess. Like, the employee can be a little bit more of that, and I can learn and understand. I've really embraced that side of the business. I think most CEOs are like anti-HR, and HR is one of my favorite departments because it's people. Mm-hmm. It's the people piece, and how do we, you know, if we have 300, 400, 600 people, including retail, like, we can make a really big impact on their lives, and that's special and important, and in some ways more important and more special than the business we're running. Like, the people are the secret sauce and DNA, and if we can keep them motivated and happy, Like, that's what creates our happiness. So that's a big difference for me. At 30 people, it wasn't about like, let's keep our people happy. It's like, let's go run this brand. Let's go kill it. And let's like drive as hard as we can. And now it's like, you know, let's still keep that edge on us, but let's have a more reserved approach on like, let's make sure people are happy doing it and we're not wearing them out.
With being in a business for 16 years, you've probably seen some war stories. What was the biggest challenge, or like, was there a time you thought you were going out of business and you overcome it? What was like one, like any near-death experiences that you were able to come out on top?
We really didn't. We were super lucky because we had that multifaceted approach with wholesale and direct consumer where we never were really, you know, in jeopardy. We kind of, you know, went from 3 million to 6 million to 12 million to 20 million to 28 million to 38 million. So it was always like gradual. And I think I give Travis a lot of credit for this. Travis was more of like a stop sign guy. Like he definitely would be like, hold on a second. Like, and I think in that early portion of growth was so important to say, let's not move so fast. Mm-hmm. Like, we could do all this stuff, but let's slow down and let's like figure out how we can accomplish this, build the timelines out. Let's not implement all these things at once. Let's like slowly do it. So we avoided a lot of the pitfalls, and be honest, like when I took over, and I'm probably like too much of a green light guy, because I'm telling the team, like, hey, I'm going to go 100 miles an hour. I might slow down to 85 if you ask me. I'm not going the speed limit, and do not ask me to stop. Like, that's not in my vocabulary. And it probably, as we got to 22 and, you know, COVID didn't help that, we were going so fast that it's like, this thing's going to break. We're not building enough process along the way. We're still like driving this boat like it's a Zodiac, and I don't want to be a cruise ship, but like, we probably need to not turn so fast in so many different directions. So I would say like COVID was really what hit us. Cause like, you know, when I took over and Travis and I were having a lot of conversation, I mean, at one point in 2020 we came off a year doing 110 million. We thought we might do 30 million. I mean, that's how crazy stuff got for a short period. And
that next year.
In 20 when it hit. So COVID hits in March.
Oh yeah.
Right? Our peak season, 40-50% of our business at that time was March until July. So we're going to lose half our revenue. And then is anyone going to want the product back? And what are we going to do with all this product that we have? And so we had to make a lot of moves during COVID to get right. And then we bounced back, obviously, in 21, like a lot of people did, but we were more prepared than ever because probably we were more pessimistic than ever. So we made a ton of moves from that May to like August to say, hey, we're going to right size this thing and just count this as a lost year and really get ready for next year. And so we got to 21, we were ready to go, and we stole a ton of market share. I mean, in our industry, we probably stole 8% market share from 21 to
And the golf boom kind of happened at the same time.
The golf boom happened at the same time, yep.
Did you guys get hit with overbuys going into 22 with maybe a lot of brands?
Here's what I did. It's pretty simple. Shut down in March. Mm-hmm. We deliver every month. I took our April and May drop. I moved them to January and February of 2021.
Okay.
Our end consumer had never seen it. Our buyers had, our end consumer hadn't. Our brand is one of such that, like, it's fairly timeless.
Yeah.
So you want the new, fresh stuff, but it's very timeless.
As long as it's new,
So making that move, and I knew, even if we popped out of this, say, in May or June, no one's going to want to buy for 2 or 3 months. So I bought us 2 or 3 months to make that March buy. Because I had Jan and Feb covered, I don't have to buy until March now, so we're not going to have to buy until August, September. In addition, we had a lot of carry core, so we found a liquidation partner, moved all that carry core in June and July, and we're out of it. So we right-sized inventory levels.
Got your cash back.
We didn't have to buy until March. And then once we got to August, especially in golf, they were up and running. They had been running June and July, and they were ready to buy. And so we avoided disaster, and we were probably the only people in 21 in our industry to ship on time.
Yeah, because everyone was either hit with port delays. Yeah.
And I had the product to ship.
Yeah, so it almost worked to your benefit by pushing it out to January.
Yep.
And you...
we lost a year. No one got bonuses. There's a lot of negative things that went on, so I want to over...
You had to fight through that year.
We had to fight through the year. Yeah. And there was so much uncertainty with people's jobs and everything that goes on with it. So it wasn't... In hindsight, there was a lot of positive that came, but there was also negative.
How did you... Because we've been through periods like that where it's less advantageous. And I think for us... We got hit with overordering going into 22 because same thing. It was in March of 2020. We were like, you know, we had only grown up 100% year over year. Most years was much more than that. And then we had just had a huge delivery coming in March for about, remember, like for a 10-day stretch, everyone thought you were done.
Yeah.
Like I was like, I think I sent it.
I thought it was like a 45-day stretch for us.
I was like March, like maybe 8th to like April 1st. And then by April 1st, it was nuts. Mm. And then we sold out of everything we had by June. So then all of June and July, we almost had no tees. And then it was really...
Well, I think that's the beauty of an e-commerce business. Because yeah. for us, retail was still shut down in almost all locations until June.
Oh, God.
Golf courses were shut down for several months.
Yeah.
And then off-course golf, for the most part, was shut down. But they were some of the first to come back. But we were shut down for a solid 2.5 months.
Got it.
So we were doing well on e-commerce, but we also moved platforms and moved our warehouse end of May. So that was like a 10-day gap. We didn't have sales either. So it was the right time to do it because we weren't shipping as yeah. many people, but we just had, you know, a ton of challenges being direct consumer only. Yeah, the blip was much smaller.
But yeah, I didn't even think about that. So when places were shut down, like you couldn't sell. Like,
yeah. Yeah. You couldn't sell.
That's brutal.
And then even when they opened golf courses, they opened them for multiple months without opening the golf shop. So it was an outdoor activity, so you could play.
But you couldn't
shop as close, so you couldn't do commerce.
And that was, there's favorable states, less favorable states, having a demand plan. I mean, that just must have been a nightmare.
Oh, yeah. Well, like I said, it wasn't really a demand plan. That's why, you know, we moved that product to Jan. It was already bought.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, we liquidated with outlets we could very fast, and we liquidated everything in 4 to 6 weeks. It was gone.
And did you have to take a loss on that inventory or?
No. We've been very fortunate and similar to you. We in general for a 5 or 6 year period before that, we're growing, you know, 40 to 50% a yeah. year. We were generally buying to grow about 30%.
Got
and
it.
So we were selling out, when I say to the piece, on $110 million, we might've had $2.5 million in inventory excess.
Got it.
I mean, that'd get gobbled up in 10 minutes. The demand for off price for Travis Matthew is massive because we just don't do it. And we don't have to. We have a great full price for business. We don't have to liquidate. Mm-hmm. We have Black Friday sale. We'll have another online sale a year, but that's it. That's your only shot.
Mm-hmm. What do you think of all the brands, without, you know, throwing shade at a lot of them that we know that we've talked about, like that are on sale every 2 weeks? Like,
I mean, I don't throw shade to begin with. I think...
Does that eventually stop working?
Yeah, it's not a long-term strategy at all. And we've seen it. You know, we were more promotional the last year than we wanted to be. Mm-hmm. And we've really seen that in the full price customer. And, you know, we changed our Equator footwear to Travis Matthew footwear, which many people are thanking us for and wondering why we didn't do that years ago.
Yeah.
But we're liquidating Equator footwear. Well, then Travis Matthew footwear looks similar. And so you see all this fatigue where we launch new footwear and it looks amazing. The new styles are doing great. The styles that look similar to the old styles are struggling.
Uh-huh.
And then just even, you know, fatigue from, you know, Black Friday. You know, we see it. You can see it in the metrics. We just ran, you know, something on Memorial Day, which we were going to run a sale. We're not going mm-hmm. to anymore. It's just such a strong time of year. There's no reason. And we'll immediately take those full price sales and move them up because we're not doing that promotion. So, yeah, it catches up with you. And you want to train your customer full price because we have quality product. And the end of the day, if we're going to be off price all the time, we're not going to be in business very long. So yeah, it catches up. You can get away with it for a short period of time, but the customer knows. And there's a couple brands I know that I'm just getting beat up with, like emails for sale. And I'm like, as an end consumer, even I'm like, ooh, they must be hurting. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't, you don't have confidence in the consumer in that brand.
Yeah. I think in 21 into 22 and really in 23, you saw brands, you could tell they were overstocked. I'm like, I've seen this black jacket now for, for months that they're trying to get rid of it, and it's brutal. Switching into kind of like golf, what do you think of LIV Golf? And I know you guys had John Rahm, and he moved over, and
yeah,
what's your take on where golf's at as an industry?
It's a touchy subject. I mean, I think, you know, where golf's at is, you know, you had participation at all time high over the last 3 years. It seems like every month it increased year over year. Mm-hmm. Your viewership at an all-time high as well. And obviously it's created a divide. We're seeing it. We've seen all the numbers for the PGA Tour this year.
Oh, the numbers are less effective because there's less people watching the tour.
Well, there's, you know, I don't know how many it is, but off the top of my head, 5 or 6 top 25 PGA Tour players that have moved to LIV now.
Yeah.
With Rahm being a headliner, being a top 3 player, was number 1 in the world for, you know, a steady period of time. And so now... what you have on the PGA Tour is, if you took the NBA and you took 6 of the top 20 players out of the NBA, it's a little less interesting. right? There's probably some teams you're not going to like as much uh-huh. now. And so we're seeing that, and there's definitely...
Does that affect product sales then too?
I think so. Yeah, wow. In channel, our e-commerce tends to be pretty heavily driven by golf. Mm-hmm. You know, our golf accounts do. When it comes to Nordstrom and our retail stores, they're not as affected as much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it affects sales, and especially when you're comping peak years. You're comping John Rahm winning the Masters and all the things happening. And so, you know, try not to get into the politics of it, but knowing that there's got to be a change. Everyone, I think, is crossing their fingers for a merger.
Yeah.
I think if the merger comes at some point, whenever that comes, like, golf's going to be more interesting than ever because you've had this sort of, you know, probation period where these guys can't play the top events. So you always want the best athletes to play, but there's so much conversation around, you know, whether it be Phil or Rory or whoever they have, I don't have a take on, you know, mm-hmm. who's right and who's wrong on
it. You just want
the
best people.
I think all, even as a fan and talking to my friends, we just want the best product out there, and I think we're hoping that's coming soon.
And how have you been, how have those deals that you've done, whether it's been with, because you did another one with an actor.
With Chris, right? Pratt.
Chris Pratt. If you compared like an actor to an athlete, was there a huge difference in effectiveness?
Yeah. I mean, I never even met Chris Pratt, which sucked. I mean, I really wanted to, but like his schedule is so tight. Yeah. And it's like, hey, we're going to get like 3 shots with you. And the difference between those 3 shots is like we get 3 sessions, 2 hours each, and he freaking kills it.
it's way better.
Oh, that's not way better. I would go the other way. I like, you know, our athletes that we get, like we just signed Austin Reeves. And he's super interactive with the brand, just became a member at Virginia Country Club. And, you know.
Oh, he's at Virginia?
Yeah, he's at Virginia now. Through our connections. Yeah. And then now we've made, you know, his best friend, Trent. We've made friends with him. It's a really family environment. That's what we've always done at Travis Mathew. So I always prefer that. It's very mm-hmm. organic. But when you have a guy like Chris, it's like, yeah, I mean, he gives us 2 hours and we do 10 commercials with him. And it's insane. And the opportunity is incredible. So, you know,
and they know how to hit their lines.
Oh, you don't even give him the lines, and he changes to his own, and he's unbelievable. The stuff he did for us, and just to have a guy like that for the time that we had him, I'm very grateful. But I think we're so focused. Like Reggie's a good example. Reggie Bush, we just signed, I think 6-8 months ago, and then he's got a line coming out with us. Same thing. He's just so passionate about it. He loves the brand. He's constantly, I feel like every event we're at, he's at. And so that organic interaction, it just creates, you know, you don't want it to be someone that your consumer feels like is forced to wear the product because you're paying them, right? But at the same time, like we did this with Jimmy G, you know, we started that relationship because it's like he's already wearing it. He loves the brand. We've hung out with him a couple times. Like, he deserves to get something from this. Mm-hmm. Like, he's giving us free exposure. How about we ratchet up that exposure, ask a little more out of him, but also compensate him for that. Those are the natural organic relationships where everybody wins.
Have you learned the hard way on the opposite end where it hasn't been organic and it's just flopped?
Oh, that's a good question. I would say there's definitely been some guys that we have signed and got little to no value out of. And I think that just comes down to like some of that's my green light going where it's like, you know, pandemic hit and I'm like, I want somebody from every major sport. And let's go find somebody organic. And then next, you know, we found 2 NFL quarterbacks and we've got a basketball player. And it's like Alex Cruz is a good example, who's a great guy. Mm-hmm. And we've hung out with a bunch, but we couldn't figure out how we had so many people in front of him. Right. And mm-hmm. him too. It wasn't his priority. It wasn't ours. It was really cool to get like a Laker on board, even though he got trained.
You guys are
like
local.
Yeah. And we really like him and he loves the golf and he loves the brand. But we never activated him because in front of him, we had Chris Pratt, John Rahm, San Burns, Jimmy Garoppolo, so on and so forth. And it's not that he's not important or impactful. We probably just, the roster got a little too deep. And it's like, wow.
How do you activate him to make it worth everyone's time?
Yeah, I mean, they say you should spend 2 to 3 times what you pay him. Mm-hmm. We certainly didn't do that, right? So investing in video, investing in advertising, investing in all the right things, investing in his channels really too. It's not just that. It's like the goal of Reggie is not to say, hey, to our followers, here's Reggie. I mean, that's a piece of it, but it's like Reggie is going to introduce us to a new customer base. How do we promote and activate in that customer base? So for a guy like Caruso, unfortunately, and probably Corey Seager too, who was a World Series MVP, but it's like they were so busy, we never really got them to where we wanted to be, and then we had so many guys on our roster, we really couldn't activate them. So bummed, even though I love those two guys, really bummed that we couldn't, if we had less guys and we were more focused, we probably could have done a lot more there.
And when you say effectiveness, is it based on their distribution from their channels or using them as a content vehicle to expand brand recognition through so people recognize them?
I think more of a content vehicle. I think there's some validation too. If you see Chris Pratt on a retail store, I think whether you know the brand or not, you're like, hold on a second.
Instant credibility.
Instant credibility.
Yeah.
We've seen limited effectiveness on like social to say, hey, Jimmy's going to promote the perfect polo for us or whatever that piece is. We still do it because I think it has some effectiveness, but that's not, when we hire an ambassador, the main goal is not like, hey, they're going to go build our revenue by doing this, this, and this. It's really like the multiple points of exposure along the brand, thinking about e-commerce, how we're promoting them, thinking about advertising, thinking about retail.
What you guys do TV with them as well?
TV, digital TV especially. Yeah. Thinking about, are we going to have events with them? Like we're having an event with Reggie at Century City at our store to promote that and promote what we're doing with Westfield. And so, and other things. So it's like that, all those touch points, when you put them all together, it's very successful and you can really define that. Mm-hmm. When you just say, hey, they're going to post about the perfect polo and use it to their following doesn't care that much. They're not going to be that engaged with that. So how do we get their following engaged? Show them all the cool things the brand's doing and show them that this person is actually really engaged in the brand, not just posting on it.
Yeah. How do you look at overall risk tolerance? And I'll use Cuts as an example. So like in the early years, we didn't even think about risk because it was we had nothing to lose, right?
Right.
It was like, and you've probably been there where, we were spending as much money we had in the bank to do, you know, 2 or 3X or 4X at times, what we could do with that money. And then we, you know, get to a point where you start to feel like you have something to lose, but the opportunities become more and more risky.
Yep.
For example, retail stores is a totally different business. There's, unlike e-commerce, you can turn it up and down based on results. Once you sign that 3 to 5 year lease, it is what it is. And if you do 5, 10 of them managing it, all that, how do you manage risk when the business gets to that size? And just have that like outlook to be like, okay, I think we can stomach this.
You've taken a lot more risks than we have. The volume you're at, just estimating, you know, it took us 12 years to get there, taking a lot shorter time.
Yeah.
So when I talked about our investor, you know, what I'm talking about is ROI. So he didn't want to take risks. And so by the time we got to like opening Fashion Island, and I didn't either. I had been with a company before that and we had opened a retail store and it sunk the business. Mm-hmm. It was a block off the perfect spot. And that block was 40% reduction in sales of what we would have done. And they modeled it out off of that spot. And we were just hemorrhaging money off that retail store. So I was very reluctant in saying, hey, Fashion Island, this is a really nice mall, high foot traffic. It's expensive.
But there's a few blocks that do well.
Looking back, I didn't mean at Fashion Island. The previous company I worked for, was small business.
Yeah.
We opened a retail store in Huntington Beach and it sunk the business. It was on Main Street, but it was like one block too far. So that simple metric in retail can sink you, even though you think, I see all the people, they're not walking that extra, 100 feet. And so when we were thinking about Fashion Island, we knew, well, it's got the foot traffic, so we don't have to worry about that. Mm-hmm. It's expensive. And like build outs are extremely expensive. You know, you can anywhere from $500 to $1 million to build a store out, depending on how nice you want it, if you want to build 2,000 or more square feet. So we were very conservative and we opened it and did really well. And
because then if you can do it right, then that one thing can fuel the rest of the business.
And that's the ROI component is not, don't go do, like I hear a lot of people, especially with D2C business, like let's go do 5 stores. Why? Go find 1 store in your perfect area and go nail it. Mm-hmm. And if you nail it, then go do 3. Mm-hmm. And if you nail those 3, then go do 5. So that's where I look at the risk and say, hey, these things aren't that risky if you actually, do them right and you do your research and you say, hey, what are all the metrics we need to figure out? And talking to the right people, like you can ask me, you can call me. I'm not going to tell you on air, but you can call me after this and say, tell me all the checkpoints you're looking at in retail.
Yeah.
Tell me, what you think of our brand. Tell me about your top 10 stores and having that conversation and doing your due diligence. It's not that risky at the end of the day, but it is risky if you're going to do 5 or 10. Right. But if you do 1 or you do 2 or you do 3, like there's not a lot of risk in that. So, but it's slower, right? You have Yori opening 25 stores a year or whatever it is. But they've proven the model out.
Yeah.
But you have other people opening.
And they got that investment.
Yeah.
So it's a little different.
But you have, you know, the Untuckets of the world and places like that that are opening a lot of stores that you're like, have we proven that model yet? Or do we just have an idea that, like, we need to open 20 stores, so we're just going to go do it and let's see what happens after that? To me, that's risky. But if you've got the funds to do it and you want to grow faster, so that's the risk.
Is speed.
Is speed. It's not, you know what I mean? Like, you can de-risk almost all of this by just taking your time, do it methodically. But whoever your investors are, they might want to move faster. And so that's where you get into risk, is like, even though I'm the green light guy, it's like, I do think you can move way too fast from a revenue standpoint, and making sure you're doing the proper research before you move forward. And then you're tracking what you're doing currently. And I think a lot of businesses miss that. They just do things, they don't track them. And so they lose all that information.
Yeah. We've definitely been both on the, hey, really risky and it paid off. And then also at times, too risky and, you know, having to slow down a little bit. I think the biggest thing we learned is just don't stack too many initiatives in a row. Cause then
which is hard for us, right?
Yeah,
for guys like us, it's like, I've got a OneNote with 50 of these things. And it's like, I get on that with our head of marketing. He's like, oh, yeah, I can already see him like sweating. It's like, how many of these can we do? And I've fallen victim to that too. Yeah. It's like too many initiatives at once. Just like the with Alex Caruso, it's like, we have all these things that are really cool, but if we don't focus a little bit better, then they're not going
to
work.
So do you guys use, like, to manage all that, do you guys use like OKRs or some type of goal setting? Cause, in the early days of 30 people, you can really, manage goal expectations a lot easier through emails and stuff. Is there a system you guys use for 350 people?
Not really. We've got a bunch of different systems we're using throughout the organization, and
Not like OKRs or...
No, we don't mandate. I think, you know, everything trickles down from... We have a long-range planning process. Starts in January, we do an executive offsite, kind of talk through, hey, where we want to go, where we want to be, a little bit of that, my vision of where we're going to go, and then it's each department kind of saying, here's what we did last year, here's what we think we can do next year, and not focusing on 3 years from now yet, just kind of downloading all that, and we come up with our company goals for the year. And then following that, you know, the process February all the way through until we go to the board meeting in August is our long range planning. And so we have monthly checkpoints where we go through each department, what the initiatives are. We make sure with our goals, like the company goals we put together, everything, all the goals in interdepartment roll up to those goals. And so probably a little more old school approach, but it's methodical and it works and it fosters creativity. And it's not like, hey, we're going to get in a room for the old days. It's like we would, it's almost like, I'm the owner, founder of Nike, Phil Knight. They used to have their butt faces or whatever. I don't know if you've read
his book. Yeah, I love the
book. They'd go off for 3 days, and that's exactly what we would do. We'd go off for 3 days, and not from reading the book. I read it after. I'm like, that's hilarious. That's exactly what we did the first 5 years, and we'd have 3 days, and we just come up with all the ideas. But that's in the wild creative days of, like, see if something sticks.
Uh-huh.
I'm 20-some years into this business. So are most of the people on my team. Mm-hmm. We're not just throwing stuff on the wall and see if it sticks. Like, we have a pretty good idea of the business. We know what we're doing. We need to come up with that creativity, like, on a monthly basis, and we need to keep that constantly flowing. And so that long-range planning process really builds that in, instead of saying, in 3 days, we come up with all the initiatives over the next 3 years. It's like, no, we need that constant flow of ideas and constant bouncing off each other to see, like, what's sticking in a really big way. And you said it earlier, like, what's a product idea that's like 10,000 units, not 1,000?
Yeah.
And sometimes we get caught up in that. It's like, we have all these ideas we like, but, like, what is that going to generate? What's it going to do? How is it impactful? And if it's not, let's just put that thing to the side and come up with a 10,000 unit idea.
Yeah, we've, to provide a little bit more color at that, we did, first 4 years, we really just had one fabric. We did the t-shirt, which is kind of what's around here. And then when, we had more profit, we were building out the product team. We said, all of a sudden now we can do almost anything we want in a certain amount of lead time. And that's when our first challenges really came, because it was almost the ability to do it didn't mean it was the right thing to do. It actually caused a lot of hiccups in the business, because, you know, what worked for maybe, you know, your hero product isn't going to work for the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th. And you're going to have to order it different. So kind of balancing out opportunities is something through trial and error we've had to really learn. And we've gotten so much better over the last 2 years. But we were young. I was a young CEO, not a ton of experience. And I think over the last couple of years, I've really learned how to, like, the difference between cash flow and EBITDA and the difference of free cash flow specifically on a balance sheet is so much different.
But what's great is because you didn't know that before, you weren't like an expert there, you're not constrained. And that's what I'm saying when we went off and did our butt faces or whatever you want to call them. We weren't constrained by thinking about like all of these things that could stop us. Mm-hmm. It was more like, what's the potential? What can we go do? And I think that's the beauty of entrepreneurship. And like the foundation of the beginning of these companies is like, you can do anything and you're going to think about it differently and you're not going to have the stop sign up. You're just going to run. And then as you grow and you get bigger and bigger, you have to start thinking about that more and being more strategic and saying, we've got, you know, on the men's side over 1200 SKUs. And it's really difficult to say, you know, if you think about SKU planning, you know, we have in a season, 6 month season, we have about 65 unique SKUs of polos. I'm not even talking carry core, which is more than all these SKUs. So 65 unique SKUs of polos that have a different print, stripe, whatever.
65, and that's not including size.
No, I'm not including size. No, okay. We have way more if you include size. No, I'm saying so unique style colors.
Wow.
Right? No one repeats in the line. We have about 12 to 15 of delivery.
Yeah.
So with that many SKUs, we average like 6,500 to 7,000 units per SKU. So how do you look at a SKU plan and say, hey, we'd like to consolidate this from 15 to 12? Well, my 12, 13, 14 are doing 2,500 to 3,000 units each, which is still for a fashion SKU, extremely productive.
Yeah.
And now we flip it and start talking about something like denim. I was telling you earlier, denim is our number one selling item in our retail store. And it's like, if you were analyzing our business, you'd be like, do not touch denim. It'd be the dumbest thing you can do. You guys don't know denim, but we had a perspective. We had a unique product. We knew how to market it to our customer and it's killing it. And so it's like, those are challenges I'm having now to go, okay, as we get into outerwear, like how deep can we go here? I only have so much space in our stores. Sure, I can fit everything on e-commerce, but I can't market it all. And so those are some of the challenges as you grow is like, what is the right SKU count? And how do you like tell, you know,
all those stories?
You can't.
Yeah. What's right. We're way less stores, but what's right for retail is not necessarily what's right for e-com because, you know, your CPA cost for a given product online might work, but it might not work in the store too. So how do you manage demand planning with newness?
Oh God.
with, you know, e-com versus retail versus wholesale. Because there's different.
It is so, at the size of our business is and the structure of, you know, again, I'm throwing round numbers out because it's not exactly, but 20% e-commerce, 20% retail, 20% big box, 20% golf, and 20% corporate. We're almost within a 15 to 25% range for all those. So you've got five unique sales channels that run completely differently, need different product. How do you not take a SKU count from 1,000 to 3,000, right? Because you want segmentation. And then you the intricacies of like how we build into. So go to market is something that I don't know if you guys do a ton of, but like we haven't had a real go to market until really like 2 years ago. And we hired ahead of that. And now it's like, it used to be me and the merch team. We'd go build it. We'd think about how we want to market it. Eventually, we'd throw it to marketing and go, hey, we've got this great idea. What do you think? It's amazing product. And they're like, yeah, I don't know how we're going to bring this to life. The product looks great, but we don't know how we're going to bring it. Or it's one piece. Why do we care? So we started bringing marketing very early in the mix, and that started working. And now the product marketing stories are flowing great. But then it's like, to your point, planning, retail planning, merchandising, retail merchandising, e-com, e-commerce, all that stuff, marketing. It's like, you have to bring it all together. So we've built a robust marketing, you know, or excuse me, go-to-market plan where we're bringing people in very early. Finance and ops are extremely involved with that process. Because before it was like, I'll tell finance and ops what they have when we have it, right? We get to costing. It's like, here we go, let's talk to finance. And it's like really learning the value of bringing everyone in the organization in very early without like, how many meetings can we have with 65 people on a meeting?
It's impossible.
Yeah. So it's like, we really have to have those meetings and then everyone has to go off on their own and do their own meetings. And then we have to circle back on that and say, okay, what's the feedback now? So by the time we get to like the line's done, we're all aligned. Cause what was happening is we're building product. That's beautiful. We know exactly how we want to sell it. We're learning how we want to market it. And then by the time it gets a plan, they're like, well, I didn't really like this. So I bought this. I'm like, what? Like, No. That we built the line because of this. And it's like, well, they never came along for that story. So, of course, they're just looking at data saying, well, this didn't do well. Well, here's why this is different than that.
Or what's worse is when maybe it was a bigger opportunity than was bought for because marketing loves it, and then there's no product left.
Yep.
We've definitely been caught with that where the marketing team can, you know, we're dealing with this with women's right now that's really doing well, but there's certain SKUs that were like, man, like – you know, we're first order profitable, the CAC's super low, but we have no product. So now what we try to do is we actually just do it there as early as like the very, very beginning. Because if it's not at least aligned, hey, is your gut feeling the same as our gut feeling?
Yeah.
Because product is only as good as like the emphasis of the marketing team. Like if we love it in here, oftentimes that's what drives the product. Even though, and sometimes it just takes a deeper level of focus that we always sometimes don't have. So I always tell Brennan, our head of marketing, no matter what, you're never allowed to say you don't like a product because it goes to everybody else.
Yo, 100%.
And so I never want to never hear if you don't like it.
I love that. And we went to buying now once a month, which is hard for me to wrap my head around again, because we've come from this very nimble business. Mm-hmm. That's like, no. We start pre-booking May 1st. Like, we're not going to buy it May 5th. Like, we need to wait until May 30th to get all our pre-book. Mm-hmm. And it's like, no. That's not going to work in our calendar. Like, we have to have this monthly process. If we're buying every 2 weeks or every 2 days, we can't get the right roll-up to say, hey, what are we doing as a season? How does that apply each delivery? And so we started basically buying each delivery together rather than, oh, these four shirts are due today because that's what the buy date says. So let's buy these four. But then next week, let's buy these six. Uh-oh, a bunch of orders came in for those, like, and we've already bought them. So now what do you do with these? Do we buy less with these? So having, again, a more robust process, which, again, it's tough because when you go from little process and you're super nimble, which is fun,
yeah,
you know, you really have to embrace, like, hey, for this thing to get to where we want to get to $1 billion, to get to that point, like, we've got to build these robust processes and be okay that, hey, we may lose 5% here or there, but at the end of the day, like, we've got it complete and we're all going the same direction.
Yeah, that, man, $1 billion, that's your goal, is $1 billion in revenue.
That's my goal, yes. We're not putting a timeline on it because that's always the second question asked. But,
yeah,
I think...
It's good to have a big-ass goal.
And you have a huge goal, too. You had a bigger goal than that, actually.
We want to do $1 million, too.
I heard you want to do bigger. You wanted to be as big as Lululemon.
We want to... hell yeah, let's go. Why not shoot for that?
A certain market cap. No, I totally...
Oh, yeah, I did say that to you. Yeah.
And was I not supposed to share that? No, that was on a podcast you said it.
Yeah.
I do my homework.
Yeah.
But yeah, so we were in Nordstrom. They do something called Nordstrom Live. Super cool. It was in New York. We were one of the youngest brands, and they've got, you know, Armani there, and they've got Hugo Boss, and they've got the head of Hugo Boss, you know, coming in. Everyone's flying from all over. It's a big deal, and we're this, like, little brand doing, you know, a couple million bucks with them, but having some success.
Yeah.
And so we went up there and gave our presentation, which was very different than everyone else's. It was not like a fashion presentation. We were like hyping it and having fun and getting everyone rowdy and whatever and showing them what we do. And the crowd was having fun with it. It was all the Nordstrom executives. And then they bring their like top 50 salespeople. So we did a PowerPoint. And the last presentation was a golf cart. And he's going like this. And the moon's up there. So he's headed to the moon. And
I would have loved that.
What represented the moon, we said, you know, number one men's brand in Nordstrom. And which got so many chuckles. And then we were like, that's when we get dead serious and kind of just serious out on them. And they were like, oh, they're serious.
And now you guys are, right?
And now we are. And I think we got to that point in like 2021. And there's stipulations about other brands that have women's, whatever. But for our department, number one brand in Nordstrom. And so, I don't know if you can see it into existence, but I think you have to have that vision to say, hey, you know, to me, there's nothing stopping us, maybe outside of me, from becoming a $1 billion brand. So like, I've got to get us to that vision along with the team. But the team's great. I know they can do it. The product line's there. You look at the brands that are, you look at a Lulu, which I respect a heck out of Lulu, but you look at their men's, I don't know what they're doing in men's, but a couple billion.
Yeah.
There's no reason. Our product line is so much more vast and so much more versatile, and they have great product and a great niche. I'm not saying that, but on the men's side, our product's so much more versatile. Why couldn't we get there? Mm-hmm. Right? Like, and then now we're introducing women's, and now it's not just, hey, the number one men's brand in Nordstrom. Now it's thinking about women's, thinking about globally what we can do. So tons of opportunity out there for us. There's no reason we can't get to that.
What is there anything that would scare you? Like, what's the biggest thing you're looking at? Like, man, that's going to be a big hurdle.
Well, I mean, the economy scares me right now. Yeah. It definitely scares me. But again, to me, that's just slowing things down. It's not stopping them.
Because everything's cyclical, right? So, I think about that all the time as a business owner of like, you know, but it's hard as the one calling all the shots to let that be an excuse, right? Because you can't control that.
No, so and I think that's
a huge mistake.
I've seen some businesses within Topgolf Callaway and other businesses when they pitch, and that's one thing I hate, like playing the victim.
Yeah,
everyone's facing the same issues.
Yeah,
and this is the exciting time. I mean, COVID's, it's plenty exciting when things are going great and like everything's working. But I go back to COVID and like that was one of the proudest parts of my career, of how we handled that and all the challenges.
Had the comeback of it.
Yeah. And it's like being on a championship team, right? If you didn't grind, you didn't put that work in and you won it and you were the seventh guy and you didn't really do anything, it's not that exciting. What if you're the 10th guy and you put everything you had into it and you contributed that much, you're stoked, right? And so you get out of stuff what you put into it. So it's like these tougher times really make you. And like for our company last year, you know, obviously things started going backwards big time, not in terms of revenue. We're well up in revenue, but we saw this coming a lot earlier. And we were able to really save off our bottom line last year. And we hit our total bottom line.
Just kind of the slowdown overall.
Yes, it was a slowdown, but it was more of like the ramp up. And like we couldn't turn the hose off. And then it turned off very quickly and it started going down. And again, we were still seeing 30% year over year growth, but we're projecting like 60, right?
So based then your on what cash was happening. Is gone.
So yeah, we still have plenty, but it's all a forecasting game, right? Yeah. So if we were private, it wouldn't have mattered. It'd been great. We had an insane year, but being public reporting up, like we have to hit certain metrics, right? And we hit our company goal despite, you know, revenue dropping 20-30% to where we had forecasted. Again, still up 30%, but that's a monumental comeback to say, hey, you hit your bottom line goal with all those headwinds going on, but we were super responsible. And I'm more proud of that year than I was in 2022 when we beat every goal by a mile because everyone beat every goal and it was easy, right? When it gets difficult, this is when it gets fun, and guys like you and I roll our sleeves up and say, good. Let's get it, because now things are tough. Now we can really showcase, because when things are tough, people showcase their true colors. And you're either going to fail or you're going to have success based on, are you going to roll up your sleeves, not play the victim, and go, I'm going to go get it. There's opportunity out there.
Yeah, and I think when you want lots of success, sometimes God puts you through test because in order to climb that mountain, you have to have learned the hard times. So you can't have it both ways. You can't want a ton of success and then not have hard times. It's kind of a prerequisite to getting to that top of that mountain.
Well, all I'm saying is I don't think it's as exciting or rewarding.
Yeah.
When you hear people that win championships, and it'll always be interesting, the ones that they're the most proud of, but it's always the one they went through the most turmoil. Mm-hmm. It's not the one they won, they swept.
It's not the
70. And won every game by 40 points. Yeah, it's the ones that was like, hey, nobody expected this, and we took everything we had, and we put everything we had into it and got it done.
Yeah, it's like when KD joined the Warriors, Steph, when he
right. That's not his favorite championship. I can tell you that's not Steph's. I mean, kudos to KD, but
yeah, Steph. When he won the last one, he goes, "This one's the best."
That's the one.
He said it. He was like, "This one's the best. It's not even close."
Yeah,
because like you know they had seen that mountaintop, and then you know having gone down, we're one of the worst teams in the league, second overall pick, and then to win it again a year and a half later, that's pretty special.
Yeah, crazy.
What advice do you have for that 20-year younger you? Who's just getting going? And your story, you know, we talked to a lot of founders who maybe started the business, and now, you know, you're running a public company, and you are the right hand man to the guy who did. What advice to maybe you have to someone who's maybe not starting a business but wants to be in a startup to, you know, have a potential outcome like you of being a president?
Yeah, I mean, it's not that you wouldn't change anything. Of course, there's things you'd change, but I would just say, I don't think there's enough people that kind of have the mentality of like put the work first and then kind of ask second. And I think that there's so many people now that it's like, hold on, I want title. I want this. I want that. And I think one of the things that really benefited me was I could have asked for more. I probably would have got more. You know, I could ask for more title. I could have tried to move quicker, but I understood the pace and what, like every time I was like feeling comfortable, it's time to move on.
Yeah.
Right. And every time I'm like, I need that healthy fear of like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. I'm still like a CEO. I think it's okay. I think people need to learn to live with that fear of like, I could wake up tomorrow, Steven, and I'm like, I'm the best damn person at this. Like, no one can do this better than me right now. And then I can wake up the next day and be like, I'm in over my head. Like, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And so I've always had that healthy balance of like not being overwhelmed in either position, not getting cocky because I feel like I'm doing well, and not being like, what am I going to do when I'm doing poorly? So I've always taken the time to say, especially when I'm feeling like I don't know what the hell I'm doing, is like taking that time to regroup. And I think early in my career, I didn't do enough of like taking a day, taking 4 hours and just thinking about my life, my career, and life goes with it. That's the one thing I didn't think about. I was just going and grinding, working eight. I mean, I would get in at eight. I'm out at 8:30 at night, 9 o'clock at night. And then I'm, you know, some days I work till midnight, and you're not really, you're not being strategic at that point. You're just doing. Mm-hmm. And I had the energy to do it, but I probably could have moved faster and been better and more thoughtful about who I was and what I was doing if I did that. I told you that crossroads where it's like I had to have Travis tell me, dude, you're not good at that. Like, this is what you do.
Yeah.
Right? You could do it, but, like, this is where you excel. So I think being...
And you had the humility to accept it. Not everyone does in that position.
And I think self-reflection and humility are really, you know, you've heard me talk today. It's not like I'm this genius that came from my background. I come from a back... What's cool about my... where I've come, I come from a background everybody comes from. Like, I went to school, I started in retail, anybody can do this, right? Yeah. But it's like, I really had that perseverance and hard work to say, I'm going to be self-reflective, look in the mirror, really try to figure out where my flaws are, stop focusing on just the flaws and really focus on where I'm good, and go drive where you're good. Mm-hmm. Like, everyone wants to paint this picture of themselves that they're great everywhere, and they're not. And I think my evolution has been like, yeah, I'm not that good over there. I probably need to hire there or be in a position I can have success. And even I tell people in our roles, everyone wants more responsibility, more power. And people that get that a lot of times, like, they go so far backwards. If you can be A plus in three areas, think about the three areas you can be A plus and be okay being B. You shouldn't be a D or F anywhere, but be okay being a B or C over here and just driving these three things. And I think that's what I see of, like, good CEOs or just good employees. Like, they found their niche of, like, I'm great here, and I'm just going to keep driving and be relentless. And no matter what happens, like with Travis Matthew, I promise you, product is going to be great. Mm-hmm. You know, sales are going to be great. And retail is going to be great. And the other things, there's other things that I'm going to be good at or I'm going to have great people at. But no matter what, those three things are going to be awesome. I think people lose sight of that and think, I need to know everything in all parts of the business, and they lose focus, and focus on what you're great at.
Yeah, I see. And obviously you probably see this more, but with young people, sometimes they get too caught up in titles a little bit or wanting to move. And my challenge is focus on maybe the scope of, like, you know, if you've been doing something for X amount of years, focus on, you know, scope and impact that you want to have, at your role. Because, you know, a business like Cuts, there's not always going to be, like, promotion after promotion. Yeah. Like, at some point, there's just no more places to go. But from a scope perspective, you know, you can, you know, and in impact, more importantly, you know, there's always places to have impact. So if you think like that, that's thinking like an owner. Because, you know, me and you, we're like, okay, we need bottom line. We need sales growth. We need this. That's what's going to drive the best results for employees with their employer.
Yeah, if you think like an owner, but again, you go put the work in first, and then go have the conversation second. To your point, title, comp, all that always wants to be talked about first. And I think, you know, in some respects, I look back at my career, maybe I should ask for more like that. But then I'm sitting here and going, you know, there's another way to do it too. And I think there's not enough people that go, all right, let me showcase what I can do first. Not tell you, not just tell you where I'm great. Let me showcase where I'm great. And then we'll have the conversation after. And I think the people that do that, in my business, get over-rewarded. I'm always looking for the people that are like, hey, they didn't ask, and look at all the great work they're doing.
Totally.
If you're doing great work, I promise you, you don't need to tell me.
Yeah.
I'll go talk to this person, that person. It resonates throughout the building. The building knows you're great. If you're telling me you're great, and I haven't heard it, it probably isn't. There's probably something there that we need to work out. But that's what I love, is like, I know who's doing great at our brand because people tell me.
It's funny that you mentioned that. Yesterday, Jeremy is my EA. He was chuckling over there. But I put out this tweet. It literally almost verbatim said exactly what you just said there about the last thing you want to do is tell your boss what else you're doing. Hey, by the way, I'm doing blah, 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 boom. Your boss will see it if it's making an impact. You don't need to say it.
And think about the impact when he finds it out and you hadn't told him.
Yeah.
10 times the impact, right?
Yeah, because it doesn't feel like it's unorganic.
Right.
Like it doesn't feel like you were necessarily doing it for something. And a good boss wants to reward those people rather than kind of get annoyed or like a Slack message. That's the worst.
I'm not annoyed anymore because it's so rampant that I actually don't look at it as a negative. I think it's actually become the norm. Mm-hmm. So I'm okay with it. I'm okay with having those. I never want an employee to feel like they want to have a pay conversation or any conversation about title or any of that. And they can't. I always embrace that. Come to me. Let's have the conversation. And it's different than it was 20 years ago. And so I'm used to it and say, hey, this isn't a problem with them. This is normal now. But there's just an appreciation So it's not that I'm annoyed by the person that's doing it. It's more like the person that's not. There's just a great appreciation for that.
How many direct reports do you have? You know, when Travis from Uber, you know, how that big that he was famous about only having 7.
Yeah.
Like what, how many people do you have?
I do think 5 to 8 is a sweet spot.
Yeah.
I think at my level, 5 is not enough.
Yeah.
When you're impacting the business, you start to lose sight of somewhere in the business. But when you think about like having your touch bases, really driving with that employee, I mean, you start getting over 8, all you're really doing is touch bases. Because you got to remember, like, in a big organization, I'm still going to have a touch base with CEO of Callaway and the head of ops for Callaway and the head of, you know, CEO of Topgolf, as well as there's interdepartment people I need to have like skip levels with, right? So you got to be careful of having too many one-on-ones. You got to get work done. You know, I've had, as crazy as it is, last year we had 2 executives that left, and three executives that left in a pretty short period. I had 35 direct reports at one point, consolidated that to 27. 3 weeks later, consolidated 18. It's a nightmare. It's a nightmare.
18 is a lot.
It's a nightmare for everyone. It's, you know, for me, it's like the workload was insane. And then on their part, they're not getting, it's 30-minute touch bases. They're not
every other week.
Every other week. Exactly. Yeah. You can't even do it weekly.
Because if it was weekly, it would be 18 times an hour. That's your whole.
I think 6 is a sweet spot, 6 or 7. 6 or 7 is a sweet spot. 8 feels like we can manage it for a bit. We should probably consolidate at some point. 5 feels like too light for me. I know a lot of people say 5. I think that's too light. I think you lose sight of some parts of the business if you only do 5. And you've got some people at your level that you need to mentor and train. So it's finding that right balance, because, again, it's all about the people. And so, you know, if you find the right people, you have the right time you can spend with them, you mentor them correctly. And for my people, it's not like I've got people 20 years in the business that know what they're doing, but they need guidance on what is the overall vision of the business, and how can we look at it from a different lens than just mine, who's been doing this for 20 years?
Yeah, outside perspective. How do you, so one of the things I've realized is, and I'm curious with these execs at Loft, is the people that usually do the best at cuts are the people that just really love cuts. Because you can find a lot of people that are good at, you know, good at merchandising or good at product design, but if they're missing that, like they just think cuts is the coolest thing and they're stoked to work here, then it almost doesn't matter how good you were at your job. That extra 15% is what, you know, there's the difference between a C and an A player. Yep. Do you find that to be true?
Well, it's so interesting that you're saying that, because it's just, there's so many similarities to your business today to where our business was. And then there's been an evolution. Yeah. So funny, not funny enough, but oddly enough, the 3 people that left were all, you know, 10 plus year people at Travis Matthew.
Oh, wow.
And we were going through a transition where, you know, that didn't cut it anymore. Like the idea for so long, that employee you just described is like, that's it. You just love the brand, have passion. Obviously, you have to be thoughtful and intelligent about things that are going on, but basic qualities. But just if you have the passion and drive, we go. That started turning into, as I was telling you earlier, hero ball. And so those people would do everything, but they wouldn't necessarily train the people under them because they don't. They see these people without the same passion. It's like Kobe. He's not really like, he didn't want to let those teammates have their shine late in his career. Cause like, you guys don't have this passion. I don't see you working like I'm working.
Yeah.
I'm not giving you the ball. That's kind of what we saw. And so we had, and these 3 guys, all different circumstances. So if they're listening, I'm not, you know, I love all those guys and they have great careers, they're off to different things, but it kind of, you know, it was a huge negative for a couple months. And then we've hired people that I've always had that mindset. It's like, I don't want a 20-year vet that's been at this because I need a TM guy. Mm-hmm. And now it's like we found TM people that have all this experience elsewhere that have this unique perspective, because you have myself, 17 years. You have our head of marketing, our CMO, who's 15 years. You have Joey, our head of product. Yeah. We have plenty of guys that are like bleed TM, and we have plenty of those throughout the organization. At the executive level, we definitely got to a point where like it's more valuable to have somebody with outside experience with diverse opinions and that can bring to the table things like go to market that like, if I stood that up, I could eventually, you know how much time and effort that would take me versus like bringing a CFO who understands that process backwards and goes, I'll stand this up for you. Let's go.
Yeah.
Right. So that's the shift. But I think at your size, I totally get it. We're the same way, but at some point as this as you get to 200, 300, 400 people, the organization gets so big, you need to have it work like a machine.
Well, there's not as that. Well, I think
you need to not rely on one person. And that's the thing. If that person walks out the door and the building's going to, you know, blow up, they're either not doing the right things, right? Or you might want to look at finding somebody else because they've made themselves invaluable for a reason. They want to be the hero. And it's like, I feel great about our team where it's like, you know, I've taken three vacations in the last 4 months. I don't know that I've taken three vacations in like a 3 year period.
Yeah.
And it's because I trust our team. We've built something incredible. And honestly, it's elevated me to be better at what I do.
Mm-hmm. And I think I would say the negative with that is if, you know, we've had a lot of people now that have, we're only 6.5, 7 years old now, but the tough part is when you've worked with people that set the plan and let's say the plan works, or let's just say it doesn't. If that, you know, brain trust was the one that something didn't work out, it's hard for that same group of people to be like, let's try this without that group being like, well, no, you were part of that plan. So how have you managed those outside perspectives without maybe, you know, taking away from what made you guys special?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is onboarding. And it's hard, again, when we're your size, there's no onboarding.
Yeah.
Here's a computer.
Let's go.
Let's do it, right? At our size, it's like, it was painful. I had a painful last year because I hired on three executives. Three left, hired three.
And there's growing pains.
I made sure with each one, like, we're going to vet through this process. Our agency, we had an agency, thank God, because our internal team would have hated me. I mean, we went through 25 candidates, you know, interview candidates, not just like looked at 25 candidates. We need to find the right person. And once we found him, I said, hey, here's what we're going to do. We're going to have a full onboarding plan for you. So your first 90 days are not decision-making days. Mm-hmm. You're really going to learn the business those first 90 days. Because where we've gone wrong is we put people in these positions, they go. And they're running and they're doing it the way they used to do it. They haven't learned how we do it. And it causes a lot of frustration. And I actually, the last exec I hired lasted 6 weeks because I told him go. And he was doing it all a different way. He was making everybody mad. And then he actually quit. He just got himself into he was like, I can't keep up with this business. It's too fast. So I learned my lesson on that. And so it's really having a good onboarding process and saying, hey, we're going to let you learn. And it had the opposite effect with the last hire I had, which is pretty funny. I'm not going to say his name, but he'll know if he's listening, which is he was like 4 weeks in and we had a bunch of meetings and he's just quiet. And I know he's super intelligent. I know he's the right guy for the job. Mm-hmm. And so I brought him in after one of the meetings. I said, hey, Bill, look, we're in this meeting about women's strategy. And like, you didn't even speak in it. And I'm asking you for your opinion. And he goes, well, you said the first 90 days, no decision-making. And I said, yeah, Bill, when I said no decision-making, I meant we want to hear your opinion.
Yeah.
So show us the other side, if there is another side, or say you agree, and then let us make the decision and just watch the process the first 90 days. But I absolutely need your inputs, right? So it told me we're doing the right thing. It's like, okay, they're getting the message, but like we need those inputs too. So that's the game changer for me is, you know, we bring those people in before and just say, go. And it caused a lot of chaos and a lot of problems. And they felt honestly too empowered early. Yeah. They felt like, I'm running this. Don't tell me what to do. I'm going. And these last three we've had doing that. And it's really, we're trying to trickle down to the director level, to the senior manager level. How do we develop that same process to go, I know there's a lot of work. I know we needed to hire you 2 months ago. Mm-hmm. I don't care. I'm going to suffer through another 3 months that are going to be really difficult. And now we're going to put ourselves in the position we're in now, which is, this is awesome. I can trust all of them to do all these things and know they're going to have the Travis Matthew perspective mixed with how they would do things before and kind of blend those two.
But if you would have never gone through the wrong onboarding,
I don't think I would have got there.
You wouldn't have got there.
Eventually I'm smart enough to get there, but I'm 16 and a half years in and it took me 16 years to get there. So no, you're right. It was such a bad situation, that situation, that I had to look in the mirror and go, man, I've screwed something up royally here. Although I could have easily blamed it on him. There was a bunch of situations with him that you're like, he definitely wasn't the right hire. So I'll start with, I hired the wrong person. But like, yeah, it was an eye opener to me. Like, you got to look in the mirror in those situations. How do you lose an executive in 6 weeks that moved from Texas?
That's you.
Relocated and was done in 6 weeks. Like, we're either developing a toxic environment or just something's going wrong here. And so it was a good, to your point, if I didn't go through that, I probably wouldn't be as strong there as I am now.
It's funny. Just this morning, me and our VP of Ops were just talking about that. It's most of the executive or higher level people that we've hired that haven't worked out, it's either been a bad onboarding process or we just didn't know how to manage them. And so like, you know, you don't necessarily recognize it right away. It usually takes a few months out of that, let the dust settles. And you're like, huh, you know, I would have handled that differently. And I think for us on the product side, we've brought on people in the past that
so hard on the product side.
It's so hard.
That's your baby. It's so hard.
And now we have like, all right, core pillars. What makes a Cuts product? before when we brought someone on, we thought you could just see it from the naked eye, but without actually going detailed line by line, you know, category by category of what we want to create, anyone who we brought on is not going to get it right. So I think those are things that,
well, I would say substance too, like substance and doers in this business, even in ours, like all of my executives, if I said, go do this, they can physically do it and show their team. And I think that's where we had gotten into problems. We'd bring people in, they'd give you a nice PowerPoint. It'd sound great. They could talk through it. They were a good communicator. But then when it came to like, you know, building go to market, they couldn't do it. Like they always had someone that did it for them. Mm-hmm. So they're like, well, I can go hire this guy. Well, now I got to hire a team just because I hire you. Like we have a team in place. Go show them how to do it.
Yeah.
So we learned through the interview process, how do we like poke holes and say, so when I ask a question, it's like, when they give me an answer, I dig deeper. And eventually I find that hole of like, that's as far as you can go. Right. Cause I know enough about this that you're not going to be able to BS your way through that. And so you learn through that process. Most of the best interviewers are full of it. They're just good at interviewing. Mm-hmm. And so you can get fooled a little bit early on. And I've learned that. And so I think, you know, for your business, product's a different beast. Yeah. Cause that's like,
again, it's hard.
But yeah. Outside of product, it's like, you really got to find out if these people have substance or if they've just been a director that's had people under them that do all the work.
Yeah. That,
and they can talk to it. Well,
we've had three or four, you know, big time people that were that. Now for interviews, I'm like, bring your computer.
yes.
Like
I love that.
Bring blank sheets if you need. We're not going to do like after the first one, you know, you do a culture fit.
You give them a project.
Project. I say like, let's actually go through like, you know, a financial model or whatever we're doing and walk me through like what you do to build that or whatever field it's in. And then another thing that I've done well is I try to do like a lunch where like, you know, this another recent person I took down to Santa Monica, we grabbed lunch. I was like, hey, let's walk and let's take some time to walk and go grab a beer. And you start to understand like good questions to ask that kind of like, there's a technique called disarming. You want to disarm people when their guard's down a little bit. Not as a way to like catch them,
yep.
But to really understand maybe how they would approach a situation and you can kind of get to it. But when it's an interview style, when it's like this, tough. Someone's going to be like either really good or they're just not going to answer what you need. But I've noticed when you can kind of go on a walk, talk about situations, you can, you know, you start to really understand both on the culture side, which is really important, which we've gotten wrong before. And also on like the executional side, you can kind of get to it, but it's still hard. I think I used to think I was good at hiring. I don't know if I'm good.
Oh, I mean, we all miss from time to time. Yeah. But I think if you got the time to do it, all the things you're saying sound like you are good at it. And I totally agree with you. I had the best interview I've ever had. I mean, he blew me away. 90 minutes. I was like,
you're like, tomorrow I need you.
No, opposite.
Oh,
I'm like, something's gotta be wrong. This is too good to be true.
Yeah.
So I'm like, let's go down. We have a cave in our office. I'm like, let's go down and have a beer. Same thing you said. Went down and had a beer.
Quickly realized.
And I caught him in like four lies in 30 minutes. Because he, to your point, he got casual. It was no longer an interview. It's like, hey, because I told him upstairs, this is going great. You crushed it. This sounds amazing. Let's talk about you, your life. Let's talk about whatever. And I don't even remember what we talked about. But it was like, boom, 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 boom. And I called his hiring manager. And I'm like, I've got so many red flags with this guy. I don't even know. And then later down the road, we uncovered the red flags and they were bad. And it's like, whoa, what a like dodged a bullet there. But yeah, I mean, if I would have let him go there, to your point, I think some people are just exceptional at interviewing and yeah, getting them in that more natural environment, you could really like see who they are as a person. It's like, ooh, this is not the person that they're portraying up there.
Yeah. We recently interviewed a guy and he was like, man, I gotta admit, I'm a little nervous. Cause when I walked in here, you guys are like a cool brand. And, versus a day earlier we had interviewed a person and he came in and he was really sharp and kind of like your experience, too good to be true. And this other guy, I think we're getting ready to hire, hit the humility just to that. Say that.
Heck yeah.
Like I got a little nervous. I saw you walking. I was re-looking at my interview and I was like, I had worked for a company for 10 years. And he's like, I hadn't interviewed in a while. And I just love that. And he was the guy that brought his computer and was going through it. And I made him walk me through what he does now. But like those little things in an interview, I'm getting better at spotting
And you taught him when he works for you now, he's allowed to make a mistake. He's allowed to admit failure. He's allowed to admit weakness. And he's going to be one of your better employees because he's going to be comfortable doing that. And so you don't have to play detective and go, what are they not good at? What are they hiding? You're going to know right off. He's just going
to
tell you.
And in an interview, it doesn't translate good to the work, because if you're afraid to tell your mistake, you're going to, let's say if there's a timeline of, 7 weeks or whatever, and week one, you realize you made a mistake. If you're the type of person that doesn't like admitting it, you're going to go another 6 weeks or whatever just because your pride is you don't want to make the mistake, even at the expense of the business. So, yeah,
when you ask people, what are your biggest opportunities, or like, what are your weaknesses, right? It's such a dumb interview question, but such a great one, because you really can learn. And it's like, I work too hard. I'm too hard on whenever they give me a positive in their weaknesses, it's like, come on, like, you're not willing to, like, what's going on that you're not willing to come out with? And I'll literally tell them in an interview, like, that's not a weakness. Why are you giving me a positive in a weakness to make it seem stronger? Like, tell me what are you not good at? There's something, everyone's not good at something. And I actually had one hire who couldn't come up with a weakness. Couldn't.
So you didn't hire him.
I've heard that before. I just haven't hired him. And we ended up hiring the guy. And he's actually awesome. So he's like the anomaly in the thing. He works he's a regional manager for us in South Florida, and he's freaking great. He's like 6'8", big dude, he ended up being an incredible employee, and he has flaws for sure. He couldn't see him, but we saw enough in him to go, okay, well, that's a red flag, but that's the only one, and we didn't find any others. Like, we can probably work with him and figure this piece out and make him kind of see those weaknesses. But I just thought it was funny, like, one guy ever I hired with no weaknesses. And I always think about that. I'm like, how did he make it past me?
Do you guys still, like, from the culture piece of hiring, like, we talk about if you can't sit in a delayed flight, if you can't grab a beer with someone at a delayed flight, then and you get, like, the icks, or, like, you just can't get through that hour-long time where you're not talking about work, you're just shooting the shit, we don't hire them. Is that when you get bigger?
That's out the window.
That's out the window.
Those are the old days, for sure. That was an easy... check, test. I don't think it's like that. I mean, look at, you start hiring that have been VPs at Adidas or where these massive companies, I mean, they're addicted to their work. I mean, it's just, they don't have a lot else to talk about, and they do, but I mean, it's like, and I'm not talking about the person who's from Adidas, by the way, I just came up with a random name, so, because she's great. Our team, I wish we did more, we're so busy, we don't get to do a lot of stuff together, and we do, we have a great time, but it's like, for us, especially at the ages we're at, we have families, and I've got a 12 and 11 year old, and almost everyone on the team has 2-3 kids, and it's like, I've got time for work and family, and there's very little time, for much else other than we're on a work trip, that's great. And so I don't know, we found a healthy balance there of
they can't be a complete, off culture, right?
No, and I think it filters. I still think as you're going to, an entry level, a manager level, they need that so much more than we do.
Because
we get so much of that love already. It's like, they need that more than we do. So I think at that level, it's super important. Yeah. I think as you go up, everyone on my executive team, I would want to have a beer with. So it's not that. It just wasn't like a prerequisite.
Got it.
And there's certainly been people at that level or at the director level that I'm like, have been incredible workers. They're like, no, I don't really want to grab a beer with them. But it's... yeah, the business, that's part of that shift from going from, that size to the next size. That's what I'm learning. Everyone I've talked to says, 500 to a billion is harder than 100 to 500. And I laughed at that statement so hard. And I'm seeing it a little more and more just in terms of, being able to adapt and make that culture shift to say, the culture you're living is very similar to where we were living. And I've struggled with that. When we had the three people that left, I literally went home, went to sleep, and I'm thinking, the hell is this company going to look like in 6 months?
Yeah.
Right? And I'm like, is this what I want? We had all these, kind of founder type, even when we're not founders, founder type people that just breathe it, that love it, and, everyone I want to go hang out with. And then, I had the foresight to go, stop, don't freak out. Let's talk about what this might look like. Let's talk about what an executive team looks like at $1 billion or $500 million.
And work backwards.
And the more I thought through it, and I tried to map that out in my head and then map it out with the key people that I care about and trust that I can have those conversations and thought process with. It's like, no, this is where we're going. It's an unfortunate situation, but this is where we need to go to get to where we want to go. And now here we are, not at $1 billion, but here we are with that team. And it's like, yeah, this was the evolution that needed to happen. And I'll bet, same thing. It's just like fate. Like, if that doesn't happen, I don't think my head gets there.
Yeah.
Right? If it doesn't happen.
You had to go through it.
It went dramatically, and now it's like, wow, what a, like, blessing. So I could understand if I was beating my head against the wall the next 3 years because we made no changes and we're still trying to run the business the same way we did before.
Yeah. What I love these conversations for me because I think 20 years, Travis Matthews, how many years has it been?
It would be 17. Yeah, July.
When I hear 17 years and, you know, I think 10 years on us or 11 years, patience is key. Like, that doesn't get talked about in entrepreneurship enough. And I think, like, at times I've wanted it all, like, yeah, in day one. But it's sounding like, you know, you guys have just, like, it's almost like if someone said, hey, what was the one thing that you guys did that, you know, why you would have success? You wouldn't be able to answer it because it was so many little things. And in the moment, it doesn't feel like you're going fast. But then after 17 years, you're like, holy crap, we've gone so fast. So it's kind of like the reality of running a business where in the moment you've probably had to feel like, man, we have to have patience. We can't, this isn't going to overnight.
And I think, like, there's no finish line in business. Like, we say $1 billion, but there's no championships won here. It just, and so it's always that feeling too of like,
you got to get your something when you hit that billy.
What's that?
You got to get your something. You got to
get something. We'll get something. 100%. But it's like, you know, every 3 years you sort of redirect and say, okay, where are we at? Let's reassess the business. And then everyone says, oh man, aren't you like, you know, hasn't this been amazing? Don't you? And you do, you pinch yourself a little bit, but you also say, yeah, but like the next 3 years are the best time to be in the company. Like, this will be the next 3 years will be the best year in the company's history. And it's been that way for however many years. And so it's like, that's mm-hmm. what's been exciting for us. And I think that's what, maybe to your point, has given us that patience, is we've never felt like we had some early founders that felt like we had, or one in particular, that felt like he had made it, and we didn't make it at all. And I think that was a good lesson learned watching him, to go, no, you've never made it, and you need to keep grinding. Like, Kevin, the second you think you've made it, everybody's passing you by. There's so many great companies out there. There's so many great founders. Yeah. There's so many great CEOs. There's so many great people that can make, that can do better than you. The second you take your foot off the gas, that's what it is. But to your point, it's like, how do we keep our foot on the gas but have that right pace to go, hey, let's be patient? Because this women's is a good example for me. It's like, I'm very patient with women's. We're 2 years into it now. We're investing a lot into it. A lot of our future, you know, hinges, $1 billion hinges on what women's does. But we've got an incredible plan. We've got incredible people driving that plan. We're staying the course. You know, over the next 2 years, we're going to tweak, but we're not going to make major modifications, even if it has success or has failure in certain places. We're keeping moving. Mm-hmm. We're keeping the course. And I believe in that consistency. And eventually that consistency kicks in and then we go. So to your point, that patience in some of the stuff we've done to say, hey, we know it. We believe in it. We're not going to invest too much in it. So let's just grow it at the right pace. And eventually it's going to pay off.
Now that you, at Cuts the Size, there's a lot of brands we can draw inspiration from. When you get to that level, like, who are you, what brands or things are you guys drawing inspiration from?
Well, we're in, you know, kind of heart of Orange County.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about Costa Mesa, Newport, all those areas, very like cutting edge, you know, action sports surf brands. Always great because they're pretty far forward in design and thinking, and it allows us to say, okay, that's inspiring of how far it could go. How do we bring this to life and say, hey, well, our customer's not 18. He's not 24. He's a little more elevated, a little more sophisticated, but he loves that. He loves that aspirational surf vibe. How do we kind of translate that over? So I would say we probably get most of our inspiration from surf. And then, you know, fabrication inspiration comes from travel and from, you know, our manufacturing partners and how we work together with them. And so we take a little bit everywhere, though. We're honestly constantly looking at everybody to say, you know, if we're, and we're obviously always looking at brands that are more expensive because we try to bring an approachable price point, though elevated. So, like, if I'm looking at outdoor, I'm looking at someone like Relwyn and going, man, they've just nailed that, like, outdoor killer. Like, they've got their customers so different than ours. Their looks so different than ours. But, like, they really know who they are. They've got a clear vision. What's making them great? What's all the details? And what can we take from a brand like that to say, if we're going to do outerwear, it's going to look very different. But, like, there's a brand I would really look at and say, and for the most part, it's going to be, like, smaller brands, too. It's like the big brands.
Yeah,
we're just looking at to say, what are they copying from us? And or what direction are they going that's different from us? But we're looking at a lot of the younger brands and you know, up and coming brands just to say, like, there's somebody that we can look at and say, hey, they're going in a direction, but we never, it's never like, hey, let's knock that off. Cause so many brands do this. So like, that's inspiring us to say, how could we, let's take Vuori's lightweight pant that they do for men and women's, which I think the women's sells, or I don't know what the men's.
The Sunday performance jogger.
Whatever it is. Yeah, yeah. It's like, okay, here's where they've cornered the market. Here's what the customer's thinking about that. What's an iteration that's totally different than that, but that could go kind of capture the same use and same customer? Mm-hmm. That's how we'd envision that. Not like, hey, go to our manufacturer, can you make this fabric? There's no point. They mm-hmm. they have that, they deserve it, they own it, and everyone behind them is just going to be a knockoff. Like, we're going to say, hey, there's a customer for that. We think our customer would like that. What's our twist on it to say, this feels like Travis Mathew feels nothing like that.
And that's the art of it.
Yeah.
Like that's the taken. Yeah, we look at like Dior and some of these high fashion brands, and how do we make it for the guy that is trying to win in the sport of business? You know, that you know, wants to look comfortable but professional in his everyday. And that's personally what I love to do. And from a vision standpoint, that gets me excited, of finding like a trim on a random piece that you're like, okay, I like this trim, but maybe it doesn't go on what they had it on. It goes on this. I think that's
a big focus of us, where we've lost a little bit, is like, we've been so enthralled in fabric and silhouette that it's like, hey, you know, we got to get back to, especially in polo, we have a great silhouette.
Yeah.
It's like a 3-button placket, fully constructed placket, self collar, you know, 35 grams of fusing. We've got the fit down. It's like, everything's in that. Like, if you looked at the whole thing, it's in the same fit. Mm-hmm. It's like, we really started reworking and going, hey, what happened to the old days where it was like, we do a 4-button placket and a 2-button placket along with our 3. We do a set in placket instead of set on placket. We do a contrast collar that would tie back to piping in the sleeves. So thinking about all those little things and going like, so we reinvented our collar, and we've got 3 collars now. And we actually have 5, but we have like 3 main collars that we have mm-hmm. in the line, rethinking about our placket and all those little details. Cause it's like, to a point, we got so good at that one silhouette, and
it
saved confusion. Because it's easy. It's like, everything fits the same. Everything wears the same. And there's so many like fashion colors. But then we got into a lot of...
Do you guys do 2 fits anymore? Or is it just 1 fit?
It's 1 fit.
Yeah.
One fit. We've really found the fit our customer loves. And it's like, you know, different in bottoms. Obviously, like, you have to have multiple fits.
But tops, you got to keep one.
And tops, they love the fit. And it's 1 fit. And it's easy. And, you know, I think for a business like yours and you know, other businesses, like, we're too big to say, hey... We're now going to make like slim fit, extra tall.
It'll be confusing then.
It's confusing. Yeah. And I went to Nantucket. I mean, this is like 3 years ago. I'm 6'5", about 200 pounds.
Yeah.
And I'm long torso. And so I was like, let me check this out. Like, I don't do special order or whatever. Yeah. I'll do cut to order, but not like, hey, you have a large tall, you have an XL tall. Yeah, yeah. I tried on XL, too boxy, too short. I tried on the large tall, and it was too slim and too long, probably like 3 inches too long. And I'm going, at 6'5", 200, is this guy 6'8", 160 pounds? Like, how, and I'm not blaming Nantucket, I'm just saying the idea of trying to be everything to everyone is really difficult. And I think companies that specialize in that should, and companies that don't specialize in that, like, you know, should probably be sticking to a couple fits to not alienate the customer to go, I don't even know where to start.
Yeah.
And now you've told me you have all these fits that fit me, but then they really don't. And I think a category, especially like Nantucket with dress shirts is a really difficult category to fit everyone, because there's no stretch.
Yeah.
It's not as universal.
We've been known for our slender style. And I think at times you would see our Facebook on comments like, oh, it's the tall, skinny guy that plays beach volleyball or something, you know? And internally we were like, okay, do we loosen up the fit? And we've overthought it, where that's why people love us. If we were to move that tomorrow, it would be a bad thing. So we look at fit from more on the style level. We only have 1 fit, but certain styles are looser than others.
And do you have a good testing model to say, we're going to test a regular fit
and
go test it to a certain amount of customers and then understand, what does that mean? Does that mean we can go sell 10,000 units? Does it mean it should be in the line?
Usually, honestly, we... Facebook prospecting creative, when the creative, because that's our, unlike you guys, we don't have retail and a ton of wholesale yet. So if we can win with a low CPA on a looser fit, that's usually a good indication that there is an audience for it. Now, does it mean it's our returning customer audience? Maybe, maybe not.
Yeah.
And but we have seen over the last like year and a half that our guy is more in tune to dressing a little looser. But as it gets too loose, then it becomes less formal. And then our anytime we try to do too informal things, it doesn't necessarily work as well. So I think with that, we kind of understand who what will and what won't.
And what percentage of people in business that you run into still have a stigma that you can't wear a t-shirt to work?
I think it's tough because, you know, our lawyers right now, they call me in cuts tees.
That's awesome.
So I think for
my dream world here, just everyone wearing t-shirts.
Yeah. I mean, I'm trying to think of a career that couldn't at least wear like a blazer and a t-shirt.
Yeah.
It would be hard for me to like accountants, like, we had like PwC, they're fast casual, like in the office.
Yeah.
Well, I guess going into my next question is from like a remote, not remote. Do you think because people can wear t-shirts is because, like, at least in Southern California, I know New York is like 95% back in the office, but it's like, there's no way 5 days a week is ever coming back. Right. Like as the standard where.
Yeah. It'd be difficult to see it coming back. I mean,
even though me personally, I would love it.
I mean, Nike's claiming everyone's coming back 4 or 5 days a week. Yeah. And they've got people now remote everywhere. So I don't know what's actually happening with that, but there's definitely been a surge of businesses coming back and saying that, which has been really shocking to me. You know, for me, it goes back to like the happiness piece.
Yeah.
You know, if we can, if remote is making people that happy and they can do it twice a week, and we can get the right production, then what are we complaining about?
Yeah.
Right? And I think, it can create some efficiency too.
Less CapEx on building, right?
Less CapEx on building. I would also think it's a good and bad thing, the stopping by. Zappos used to, their founder was really creative, and he used to say every person, I think, would have to be within 3 feet of another person, their desk, like literally that close, to create, foster this environment.
Yeah.
But then I remember we moved into our new office many years ago, 8, 9 years ago, and I was kind of the hub to everything.
Yeah.
And when I was running sales and ops, and I said, put me in this office right here. Everyone has to walk by it. Perfect. I couldn't go 5 minutes without someone popping in and going, hey. So I think there's efficiency too with, like, as much as
we need
some interaction. Like, you can literally like have a period on certain days, especially Fridays, where it's like, I can get a bunch of stuff done. Now, I don't want to get a bunch of stuff done at the expense of people not working or things like that. But if people are working efficiently at home, that one day a week, 2 days a week, 3 days a week, I think, you know, it makes a lot of sense. And especially, like, you know, one of the execs I hired is still remote, and she's functioning absolutely great. And I wouldn't be able to get her if. And our head of women's is somewhat remote. And until COVID, you know, I had been talking to her for 15 years about doing something with us. And it's like, you don't live here, it's not possible. Mm-hmm. And she's thriving. So, yeah, I think it's opened up some opportunities. If you want to get top talent, you're going to have to offer remote.
Yeah.
Unless you have some crazy ownership or things you can offer them that are financially just so, you know, so exciting.
Yeah, that's the piece. Like, we were 5 days a week, and then, yeah, with competing on, you know, getting someone starting to work, it was really hard. Like, I think at least in Southern California, because of traffic, where no matter where you are, there's a certain percentage of your staff that's going to be stuck in traffic.
Yeah.
And if they're doing that every day, no amount of money is worth it to do that 5 days a week.
Yeah, so I think with smaller private companies, it's going to be a lot less remote. Because you guys are going to have to huddle up. It's going to have to be the team. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to see everybody working. You can't afford for somebody not to be efficient.
Yeah.
And you're going to have to train them how to be efficient. So I think the smaller private company, for sure, as it gets to midsize, still a lot of that. And then I think as it grows, you know, you have to have the ability to offer remote because at, again, 300 people, they, you know, an entry-level employee is not like, hey, I could be the next CEO or I could be the next VP of sales. Well, I mean, you got 10 years to go get that job. It's not like it's not possible. But I don't have a carrot to dangle to say, hey, you could be this or that in 5 years because we're going to grow from, you know, 2 million to 50 million. And then to your point, even if you're in the same job, it's this bigger scope of the job. We still have a little bit of that. But it's like, I think without that allure, like, people are going to have to love the brand. You're going to have have flexibility, not just on remote. I think flexibility on finding people's balance. Mm-hmm. And again, taking what's happening outside of work. And now we used to shun that and go, like, you know, don't talk about work, you know, outside life in work. And it's, you know, work stays there. And when you go home, you don't talk about it. And now we're learning that that's not really the way to do it. Like, I should understand if you're an employee, like, what's important to you? And let's just start with that. Well, I hate waking up early. I'm not efficient. I want to work 10 to 6 or 5 or whatever that is. Okay, great. And I have to go home at 1 because my dog needs to get walked and this or that. Or I go home at 3 because I have to pick up my kids, but I'm back locked in from 5 to 7. And it's like, okay, great. Let's have that open dialogue, communication. Let's talk about what's important to you, and let's make sure we have that balance between what are the business needs and what are your needs, and how do we merge those two together to make sure we can create an environment you're efficient and you're happy and you're not frustrated and you're getting the things you need. And that's been the big, I think, revelation through COVID, is not just like remote work, but it's more like, hey, let's really talk to you about what your goals and desires are and what your home life's life, whatever you're willing to share, and we'll share ours. And, you know, I'm an early morning person. I told
Are you still doing the 4 a.m.?
Oh, I'm on it. I'm on
so
it.
So you're up at 4.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it depends, but generally between 3 and 4. And then
you go to bed?
My routine is, and I've been a little later than usually, but my routine is I put my phone in at 8:30 and I just never look at it again. That's where I was going with it. So I have a deal with my boss. Is like, if you want me after 8:30, you're not going to get me. Like, yeah, I better give you my wife's number or something, because I'm not, and she'll probably be asleep too, but I'm not going to answer because I put it down. I don't look at it again. So 8:30 it's down. We never touch it again. Usually put my kids down, or now lately they put me down. Yeah. If I'm not, but I'm usually asleep by 9:30. So I'm still getting 5-6 hours of sleep. Yeah. I get about 5 hours. So I'm up between 2, 3, 4, whenever, depending on what time I go to bed, but try to keep that routine. And then I work until, 5 o'clock. I try to work till 5, and like, should I tell my assistant no meetings after 5? I know everyone works later and they want to do it. I'm like, I don't work late, and I don't go home and work. For the most part, I'm on my phone. Like, I'll look at stuff, but I'm locked in. Like, when I'm home, I'm engaged. I'm available for emergency, but I'm not working, because guess what? I'm working from 4 to 7 when you're not. I'm so efficient. I get so much more done. The inefficiency late in the day where people are still emailing. Like, if I'm sending an email at 4, you're not responding, is great. I can get through all my projects, tasks.
And you can fire everyone up at 3 a.m. 4
a.m. I don't know about that. I actually think that's a negative. I think people are like waking up stressed out, like, shit, I have 5 emails from Ryan. Like, whatever, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, it's just, it's that routine. It's that balance. So it's like, other employees, like my head of design, Joey, he's a late bird. And it's like, that's fine. Come in at 9, come in at 10. You want to work till 6, whatever. That's your schedule. And you and I don't have to sync. We just need to sync up on like that communication. Mm-hmm. So I'm not like, hey, how come you're not coming in until 9? Well, dude, you're working till 6 or 7, right? So just come up with those expectations and create efficiency. And to me, it's your brain working smoothly. Like, anytime there's that chaos in there, you're just not thinking right. You're not efficient. You're not functioning. And so that's the main goal for both parties, right? From a employee standpoint, to say, that feels good. And from a company standpoint, it creates efficiency. You work better.
Yeah. Saturdays, one of the things I love to do is I go on a long run, and then we eat breakfast, me and my wife. And then usually when I get home, I like to get like 2 hours in, like midday Saturday.
Sleep?
No. of work, where I'm like my most creative, because I know there's no meetings. Cool. So like the mental freedom you have during that period of like, okay, there's nothing to me to do, and there's nothing I really need to be doing right now. You can kind of settle in, and it's usually when I think about product and vision, and like, I don't get it every Saturday because some Saturdays are certain things, but if it's one of those like dead weekends where there's not a lot going on, that's like my favorite time of the week.
That's exactly me, but 4 to 6. Like, I'm in the shower. I have shower thoughts already. I'm already like, by the time I come out, I've emailed myself like 4 things that I was thinking about the business. And then once I'm in there, it's like,
so you're in the HQ. You work out?
I'm in HQ.
Or you work out?
Yeah. I'm in HQ anywhere between 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning. And immediately when I come in, I don't do email. I immediately do that. I've already got a couple of creative thoughts going on, because I've thought about those on the way. And then I'm like, boom, I'm putting those in my OneNote. Then I'm like using that time, the first hour usually, to be creative, depending on what the week looks like. And then I'll start like diving in email. Then I'll usually at like 6:30, I'll go work out for an hour, shower, come back. And then I've got like another 30 minutes. And then people finally start coming in. So it's like, I've got a half day done. Yeah, exactly. I've got a half day done. Funny story about that really quickly. So we were looking for a new building.
The one you guys are in now?
Yes. This was a year and a half ago. So we've come off of that. We figured out a way to make our building work. We just didn't have parking. I rented 100 spaces. Unfortunately, I have Ford Riders who's having a lot of downsizing.
Yeah.
So I was up super early this day. I was on a kick, and I rode my bike, my electric bike, into work at like 1:30.
A.M.
A.M.
So
I get in at 1:30, and there's this van parked to the side. like all lit up. That's weird, but it's 1:30 in the morning. I got my headphones in. And I'm like, I don't want to deal with this, right? So I go in the side door, put my bike in, and I'm like moving slow because it's a heavy door. And I just hear Ryan. I'm like, what the heck? And I'm like, should I go over there? I don't know. This is kind of sketchy.
Yeah.
Because it's dark, whatever. And I'm like, all right, I'm going to go, whatever. So I, you know, grab my bike, ride. I'm like, ride over that way. If something happens, I'm going to ride off.
Yeah.
And I go, hey, what's going on? He goes, hey, you want a donut? You want some coffee? I'm like, no, I'm good. And he's, what's going on? Nothing, man. We're just hanging out, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like thinking.
Someone from HQ or?
I don't know. We have you know, 300 plus employees. There's definitely, and we have a lot of remote employees. There's employees. We do have full-time remote. There's employees I don't know. So I'm like, yeah. Does this person work for me? Have I met him? Like, what should I be saying here?
A coffee at 1:30?
Once you get to the end of it. So I go, do I know you? And he goes, no. I'm Scott. Nice to meet you, Ryan. And I'm like, okay, this is whoever the other guy was. And he goes, I go, what are you doing here? And he's like, well, we heard you're an early riser. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, well, we heard you're looking for a new building.
Stop.
And I go, yeah. He goes, so we just wanted to meet you, say hello. We work for this group, blah, 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 whatever. I'm like, you got to be kidding me, dude. I go, so you guys realize I was 10 seconds away from going into that door right there. Like, I barely look back at you. What was your backup plan? He goes, they just got lucky. He goes, we had an idea. We were going to come like every day for 5 days from like midnight to like 5 a.m. and try to catch you.
I would have, like, if I was them, I would have come like at 3 a.m. But like 1:30.
They would have missed me, though. That's the funny part. They would have actually missed me at 3. I thought it was genius. I go, you guys deserve my time. Like, come on in. I'll give you a tour of the office. I spent like an hour with them. I just went to lunch with the guy like a week ago. And this is like, we're not looking for a new building. We moved on. I just thought it was the most creative thing. And I'm like, what? That's what it takes, man. Like, you want to go sell me a $7 million building? You know, $7 million a year, I should say. Like,
wow.
Yeah. Does
that include warehousing or?
Well, it wouldn't include warehousing.
You would turn into
We generally pay $4 million for the building. Then we would, you know, it'd probably be a $20 million build. So you sort of amortize it over the lease. Whatever. It would be very expensive. Mm-hmm. And so a lucrative deal for them. But like, that's kind of that old school creativity that I just appreciate. I'm like,
oh, I love that.
It blew my mind. I'm like, so what happened if I took the day off? Or what happened if I traveled? What if I traveled for the week? Like, you have no idea. And so what ended up happening, I was looking for a new EA at the time. And so I interviewed this woman for EA and I kind of had to spill the beans. Like, here's my work schedule. Don't be freaked out by it, but here's what I'm gonna do. I don't expect that of you. And somehow we got into like, oh, and we might be moving, but don't worry, we're going to stay in this general area. Her boyfriend was this guy. So she tells him, and he's like, I'm just going to go stalk the guy at work. So it was small awesome. World. Anyway, yeah.
That's amazing. Ryan, I appreciate you coming today, my man. This is fun. We've been at it for almost 2 hours.
I know. I'm like, when do we bring the clock for? Because we clearly went over whatever the time was. This is great.
Jeremy does want us to stop. And if this has been fun. We look up to you guys.
Love it. Appreciate it, brother.